Before opening the discussion, the comments and questions from the floor, I'd like to call on Bob Crane for a few brief comments.
I'm going to say it's at the Hudson Institute.
Yes, excuse me. Bob is a senior staff member at the Hudson Institute in New York.
In discussing the existence or decrease of a Soviet threat, I think it's important not only to analyze what the threat, how the threat has changed, but to try and analyze what it was. When Frank says that the threat is going down, I think he's referring to the primarily the military threat, the threat of either direct confrontation with the United States or with direct, you might say, psychological confrontation by nuclear blackmail. I think it's true that particularly since the Cuban Missile Crisis, this type of threat has gone down. And I think the Soviets recognize that the payoff from nuclear blackmail isn't nearly what it once was, and they'll have to shift to different channels of foreign policy. I think that the major threat, however, even during the 1962, was not a military or a direct threat. It was indirect. It always has been an indirect threat, geared to trying to make the opponent accept the ideas which the communists want over an extended period of time. Admiral Burke, who is de Gaulle and my boss down at the Center for Strategic Studies, once defined strategy as the art of making the opponent think the way you want him to think. If you can do that, you don't have to fight wars. And this I think, is always has been and is now the basic guideline for Soviet foreign policy. In the military field, I wouldn't say that and the Soviets are now inactive, or I guess you put it, entering a period of relative inactivity. I would agree with Dick Allen that they are not, they don't have as a primary foreign policy goal the achievement of military superiority. I think they would like to have it. I think they're carrying on the research and development in the hopes that they might get it, but I don't think they're relying on it. Nevertheless, military power, even of a relatively inferior nature, can serve to influence our thinking. And particularly, I think you mentioned the field of ballistic missile defense. Some of the Soviet theorists, I think, have concluded that the chances of defense being developed more rapidly than offense, and perhaps eventually even more cheaply, is a real one. So that if they could get ahead in ballistic missile defense, or even if both the Soviets and the U.S. would develop ballistic missile defense great enough to degrade or to lessen the offensive power of the opponent, this could serve the Soviet interests. I think the Soviets are looking forward to this. It would serve their interests because it might serve to destabilize the world. It would make nuclear war more thinkable because each side could reduce the damage which the other could cause. In a world with this type of instability, the side which has the greater resolve, or the side which is willing to create instability and fear in the world, has the advantage. And the Soviets, of course, have always geared all their thinking, all their foreign policy, to the creation of instability, to what you might call conflict management. The United States, on the other hand, has geared most of its thinking to the creation of stability and to conflict resolution. As I say, if in maybe 10 years from now, or five, or whatever length it is, the ballistic missile defense can contribute to the Soviet designs for destabilizing the world, then the Soviets can use this promotion of instability to increase a sense of neo-isolationism in the United States, a desire to withdraw from this instability and from this conflict. If the Soviets can do this, then all their other revolutionary plans will have much greater freedom for action, for success. I think this is the type of long-range challenge which we should think about. I think it's more important than just the threat of nuclear war. It's a threat which is so subtle that most Americans wouldn't understand it or would dismiss it and say that the Soviets aren't going to influence our thinking because we're more sensible than they are. I would disagree. I would say that if the Soviets succeed in creating, as they're trying to do, a fear of instability, they may gain much more success from that than they would by great military superiority geared to direct nuclear blackmail.
Just to make a couple of remarks here. I was, I admit, addressing myself to some large degree to the military threat in the Soviet Union, though not exclusively, as Dick stated. Obviously, this is one kind of danger, and a danger that affects all of us if we have a nuclear war. This could literally involve our own personal extinction. And in this sense, I think there is much much lesser danger from the Soviet Union, as Bob says. My point was that we are probably over the hump insofar as the kinds of direct crises, the direct confrontations, which at least seemed as though they might have led to nuclear war in the early 1960s. As far as fourth dimensional war is concerned, Dick has made the kind of speech that I myself have made on numerous occasions, and I feel a bit odd standing up here taking any kind of opposite point of view, but I think we have to at least acknowledge the fact that our opponents are not 10 feet tall. They themselves make mistakes, rather severe mistakes, both in analyzing what's happening in our society and in analyzing their own capabilities for the future. I just want to quote one juicy little tidbit from Khrushchev's 1961 statement, in which he says, this was the famous one that laid down the whole dictum for Soviet strategy. He said, by 1965, the USSR will outstrip the US in volume of production and will outstrip the United States in per capita production by 1970. The victory of the USSR in economic competition with the United States will be the biggest turning point in history. Will exert a still more powerful revolutionary influence on the workers' movement all over the world. Then even to the greatest skeptics, it will become clear that it is only socialism that provides everything necessary for the happy life of men, and they will make their choice in favor of socialism. Now, obviously, that this condition that Khrushchev described or hoped for did not come about, and there's no prospect that it's going to come about anywhere in the foreseeable future. So he came a cropper on that particular prediction. And it remains to be seen, sure they'd like to initiate wars and liberations around the world, but there are certain mechanical difficulties in doing this in areas where you have no direct common access, a common frontier, such as the Chinese have in Vietnam. So far, there has been no particular success for any of these operations in Latin America. And the United States, if it chooses to do so, can physically block Soviet aid to any of the areas in Africa or Latin America. So it seems to me that the basic danger from fourth dimensional war is a function of how clever we are in combating it. And if, as I say, if we follow the right kinds of policies, which is not certain, but at least if we do, then I think we have every reasonable prospect of handling this kind of situation from the Soviet side also. I'd like to hope, and I certainly do hope, that Dick is correct in his assessment of communist China, but I'm not convinced that an irrational nation is less dangerous to us than a rational one, because for the simple fact that the irrational nation, is likely to go to war, which is where certainly this major danger does lie, or a major danger does lie. Even now, in the Vietnam War, we are The lives of every one of us is affected. Our own economy is affected. Our internal society is badly torn by something which is promoted essentially by the militant brand of communist Chinese ideology. Anybody who's trying to borrow money these days knows how that has personally affected him. It's certainly related to the Vietnam War. Convergence, I don't know. Naturally, the Soviets claim that there's nothing to convergence, and I have no doubt but what they're absolutely sincere about that. But can any group of leaders in command of the Soviet Union now, can they commit their successors 20 years ago to thinking exactly the same way that they think? I don't think it's possible. At least the Chinese leadership is making every effort in the world to guarantee that the younger generation coming up now will be as revolutionary as it is. Perhaps they will succeed, nobody knows. The Soviet Union does not seem to be going to quite that degree. It could be that 10, 20, 30 years from now, when men are in control who have had no personal experience with the revolutionary history of Russia, that there will be a change in attitude. I simply do not think that we can say with certainty that it will not come.
Well, I should confine myself to a few specifics. And the last point that Frank made is certainly a very important one, that an irrational nation may be more prone to go to war than a supposedly rational one. In any sense of the word, however, both the Chinese and the Soviets are irrational in the sense that they do perceive reality through a certain set of glasses with a certain hue on them, and therefore, to that extent, share common goals. But the fact that it's an irrational nation does not, of course, and Frank would agree, change the nature of the war which must be fought, nor does it change the basic conflict issues which bring about a war, nor should avoidance of war itself be our primary goal. The avoidance of war, and after all, we've been told now for 20 years that nuclear war is impossible, it's unthinkable. Herman Kahn has proved that it's quite thinkable, but we've been told this. Now, if avoidance of war over the long term can be exploited as a psycho-strategic issue, as Bob Crane has put it, psycho-strategic issue, this induces paralysis. If the avoidance of war, a la the English feeling in, say, the late 1930s, should be our prime goal, then that tends to deter us psychologically. It brings about specific and concrete political and psychological deterrence in the formulation of national policy. Now, over the long period of time, the Soviets do seek to create psycho-strategic superiority. They don't want war. I haven't excluded it possibility as a possibility in my own frame of reference. But they're looking for the creation of a kind of psycho-strategic superiority versus our own conflict resolution-oriented policy. We're interested in solving conflicts. The Soviets, say, as a matter of doctrine and have as a matter of principle and practice and policy, tried to exacerbate the fundamental issues. They have tried not for conflict resolution, but for conflict exacerbation. That is along the lines of the grand class struggle. I mean, this is perfectly existentially provable. It's provable in experience. The creation of this psycho-strategic superiority relates, I think, fundamentally to the inculcation of the attitude that we do, in fact, now have peace. And it will tend to deter us from taking meaningful action when new wars of national liberation are created. And parenthetically, I insert that I agree fundamentally that the Soviets have physical, mechanical constraints. They cannot institute a war of national liberation wherever and whenever they want, because the mechanical conditions may not be appropriate. They may not be right. But to say that they've had no success in assisting wars of national liberation in Latin America and Africa is, I think, to fly in the face of reality. In point of fact, Zanzibar, the island of Zanzibar, about which we know very little, and about which the Africans themselves, I'm speaking primarily of Rhodesians and South Africans and the Portuguese, who have the superior intelligence in the area, know very little as well. And on the other side, of course, Guinea, constitute major long-range dangers. These are the points of entry for the Chinese. The Chinese have physically traversed Africa. They sent an expeditionary party which walked across Africa from Zanzibar to Guinea. Now, that in itself constitutes no threat. In fact, it's like the 9-mile swim of Mao Zedong. But it is significant. It has certain symbolic aspects to it. And the Chinese and the Soviets, in point of fact, are working hand in hand, not coordinating their strategy on a daily basis as they did in the Dominican Republic during the period of discomfiture there in 1965, but are working not at cross purposes, but concurrently along similar lines in Africa. Now, one thing is important here. What does success mean? Or what do you understand by success when you speak of success or victory in the National Liberation Movement? It doesn't mean simply a sweeping victory whereby a communist or a crypto-communist regime is established, say, in Togo or in Zanzibar or wherever else it might be. It again pertains to the long-range nature of this threat, the steady erosion. So if the payoff of psycho-strategic operations on the part of the Soviet Union and other, actually also on the part of the Chinese communists, is going to be meaningful, and if we can be convinced in this country that we do now have peace essentially in the world, were it not for Vietnam, then over the long haul there is that psychological and political deterrent of which I spoke that will prevent us from taking meaningful action on the basis that we don't want any more Vietnams. Should something serious break out in Colombia, should it break out in Chile or in elsewhere in the world, even in the remote reaches of Africa, the people in this country are entirely sick and tired of the role of the United States as world policeman. I maintain that some kind of role of world policeman or creator and keeper of the peace is necessary for the United States. But the one thing that the war in Vietnam has done is to erode the position of power and responsibility in the United States domestically for the legitimate exercise of our power and our prestige and superiority throughout the world. If one thing Wayne Morse has done, and Senator Fulbright along with him, it is that they have eroded the credibility of the United Nations. People are sick and tired of having to settle the affairs in Vietnam. And that's why we find it's those very interventionists who during the 1930s were screaming and claiming that we must go to war to head off Hitler, who was then, of course, the bête noire of all of Europe. It's those very same interventionists of the 30s who are today the isolationists that want us to keep out. Why? Because we have peace now, essentially, in the world as they understand it, and that any further involvement will only serve to suck our blood, to suck our treasure and our resources. I agree. That's part of the risk of living in a world of conflict, to coin a rotten cliche. It's part of the price that we have to pay in exercising that responsibility. The problem is exactly as I think that as Eric Fogelman has stated it, and this is the first time I've ever cited the man, it's a profound statement. As long as the debate here rests on Gnostic cliches or irrational dream world cliches about the nature of reality, so long will the public conscience and the public action be paralyzed. I subscribe to that point of view, and I'm not attributing it to Frank Johnson, incidentally, but it is a real and present problem. The mistaking of illusion for reality, and those of you that have heard me make this argument before are probably bored to hear me make it again, but I think it's the most valid one that I can make. We have to distinguish then, finally, as a specific, between the what Karl Wittfogel has called the Homeric shouting of the Soviets. It's all well and good to cite Khrushchev about overtaking us in 1965 or 70 and 80. This is part of the Homeric shouting and the economic promises which Khrushchev has to make. And we, of course, don't take him at his word. Nor do we take Khrushchev or Brezhnev and Kosygin, or for that matter Mao Zedong, at his word that he will do this. The Soviets have been lapping up blueprints for the world since 1917 when they assumed power, and before that Marx and Engels were busy lapping up blueprints for the world and ideal societies and what they were going to do, and the handwriting is on the wall. Western society is going to perish. No one believes that. But in the real world, they are more capable of creating disturbances to the peace than they are of creating economic superiority and self-sufficiency at home.